This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
But the vote could still be tight. Smaller candidates have endorsed Mbalo, including former Prime Minister José Mário Vaz, who had a falling out with Pereira when he was Prime Minister.
That's Ricky Shryock reporting from Bissau. Details coming up also. At least 90 people were killed in a truck bombing at a busy checkpoint in the Somali capital Mogadishu. And China has replaced the West as the continent's primary creditor. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Guinea-Bissau is awaiting results from a second round of polling in a presidential election where two former prime ministers are facing off and both vowing political stability. The election comes after years of political crisis with stagnated development for the small West African nation. Ricky Shryock reports from Bissau.
Simon! Simon!
Poll workers in Bissau read out vote results one by one after polls closed Sunday evening in the second round of the presidential election. The race pits two former prime ministers against each other, Domingo Simões Pereira and Umaro Sissoco Embalo. Pereira is with the traditional ruling African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, PGC, and seen as the frontrunner. He led the first round of polling on November 24th with 40% of the vote, compared to 28% for Embalo, a former PGC member who joined the breakaway Movement for Democratic Alternation, Madame G15. But the vote could still be tight. Smaller candidates have endorsed Embalo, including former Prime Minister José Mário Vaz, who had a falling out with Pereira when he was Prime Minister. But no matter who wins, the new president will face long-running challenges of Guinea-Bissau's institutional weaknesses, say political analysts. Gilles Yabi is founder of the Senegal-based West Africa citizen think tank, WATI. He says the unclear power sharing between the president and the prime minister has hobbled the country.
That the risk is that the current elections is lead to clear results, but at the end, we have a risk of having the same institutional crisis that we had in the last few years. Everyone agrees in Guinea-Bissau on the need to revise the constitution to clarify a number of articles and also to make sure that the prime minister and the president can work really together without any conflict that can paralyze the country.
After elections in 2014, there were high hopes for the small West African country. Then Prime Minister Pereira and new President José Mário Vaz worked together to secure more than $1 billion in funding pledges at a European Union roundtable. They planned to use the money to fund Terra Ranca, a 10-year development project for the country of 1.8 million people. But in 2015, Vaz fired Pereira over what he said were ties to corrupt figures, though the allegations were denied and never proven. Vaz and the ruling PGC party could not agree on a new prime minister. Since then, Guinea-Bissau has cycled through several prime ministers. The political turmoil led donors to pull out of the $1 billion pledge. Nonetheless, Pereira and his party vow if he is elected president, they will put the development project back on course. Pereira advisor Paulo Gomes says they aim to triple the pledges from a variety of investors and donors.
The plan is still here, 5 years after, you know. We need now to see some adjustment on this, but the main building blocks are there, you know, the issue of agriculture. But the base for all of it was that we want to, each time we engage in our policy change at the sectoral level, there is one cross-cutting issue, is climate and our biodiversity. You know, we are a country of biodiversity par excellence.
Both Pereira and Embalo, who served in the military, have vowed to bring stability to Guinea-Bissau. The West African country has had at least 9 coups or attempted coups since 1974, when it became independent from Portugal. Political analyst Yabi says for the country to move forward, reforms are also needed at the military level.
Guinea-Bissau is one of the countries where the current military still have some kind of legitimacy, which is historically linked to the war against Portugal to obtain independence. So it is a country which really still need to build the state. And I think that holding elections or building electoral democracy is not the same as building a institution and building the states. So I think there is a lot of challenges ahead of the country, and it would be important that this time there is a political leadership that make it possible to push for the reforms, and also an international community which try really to help the country to build the state and not just to organize election and to fix a few problems in the short term.
As the year draws to a close, Bissau Guineans are hoping this election and a new decade will bring a new era of stability in their country. Preliminary results are expected Wednesday in the second round of the presidential election. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Bissau.
The U.S. military says four Al-Shabaab militants were killed yesterday in three U.S. airstrikes in two locations in Somalia. Reuters reports the airstrikes came a day after at least 90 people were killed in a truck bombing at a busy checkpoint in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, the deadliest attack in more than 2 years. No one has claimed responsibility, though President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed blamed Islamist group Al-Shabaab, which has regularly carried out car bombings and other attacks in its decade-long bid to topple the government. The United States carries out regular airstrikes in Somalia in support of a weak United Nations-backed government in Mogadishu, which has fought Al-Shabaab for years. Ismail Mukhtar, a spokesman for Somalia's information ministry, told the French news agency AFP the death toll could climb further as rescue operations enter a third day. For thousands of South African boys, the sacred and secret traditional initiation process, a rural retreat culminating in ritual circumcision, is a bridge from boyhood to manhood. But for at least two dozen young men each year, it is a dead end. More than 25 boys have died during this year's initiation season, many from dehydration during the trying physical ordeals. The process has always been shrouded in mystery and tradition, making it nearly impossible to talk publicly about the reform. But this year, human rights and men's groups are calling for a halt to troubled initiation schools for reforms. They also want one thing this process has never allowed: an open conversation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For hundreds of years, teenage boys and young men from South Africa's Xhosa and Ndebele groups have followed a sacred, secret coming-of-age ritual that culminates in ritual circumcision by a traditional surgeon. Initiation, as the practice is called, is part of the rich fabric of South African society. But in recent years, as dozens of young men have died during the process each year, most from exhaustion and dehydration, but some from botched surgeries, it has also become a legal and cultural minefield. This year, South Africa's Commission for the Promotion and Protection of Cultural, Religious, and Linguistic Communities called for the immediate suspension of initiation schools in the Eastern Cape province, where most of the deaths occurred. That call has earned the ire of the gatekeeper of this tradition, the Congress of Traditional Leaders of South Africa. The group's president, Kosi Maphuta Mokoena, says he agrees that schools that have seen deaths should be investigated, but that a ban is not just foolhardy, but futile.
We totally disagree with the call from the CRN, because unfortunately we were never consulted when they made this call. Unfortunately for them, even if they can make a call or even force Parliament to legislate to do away or ban the running of initiation schools, unfortunately it's not enforceable. Therefore, we'll just advise them nicely to say, come, let's sit down and talk about this. Because if you legislate on something that you cannot enforce, it is as good as wasting public funds.
While the independent government-funded group has called for suspensions in previous years, this year their call was backed by a powerful men's group. Ntando Yola is chairman of the South African National AIDS Council's men's sector. The organization supports the suspension and is pushing for an open conversation about the practice. But, he stresses, he isn't against the ritual itself.
It's a practice that's held in high regard, that a boy grows up looking forward to going through that. And I think that is fine. I have gone through that myself and I went through it willingly. However, we have got to put measures to make sure that, you know, it does not cost life. Life is more important and is equally important as the ritual.
Civil society groups have proposed several changes, including better enforcement of licensing requirements and more medical supervision over the 2 to 4 week retreats. In recent years, Zimbabwe has integrated medical circumcision into its initiation schools, leading to a drastic reduction in deaths. Mukwena says that is not an option for South Africa, though traditional leaders allow doctors to intervene if initiation leaders call on them.
How they're doing it in Zimbabwe, it's foreign. We don't don't understand why they're doing that. It's still allowed for that medical doctor to go to the mountain and assist. But unfortunately, you cannot do it in the mountain and again in hospital. It's never done that way. That is no more in initiation schools. It's something else.
But maybe it's time for change, Yola says. His group is also floating the idea of giving women a voice in the process. When it comes to initiation, the women in these boys' lives are forbidden from having any oversight or authority. And while the group isn't suggesting anything as radical as letting women witness or learn more about the process, he says the fact that they are left completely in the dark seems unfair.
One of the things that happens with the secrecy that is happening around the practice is the fact that you have women who are mothers or who are carers to these young men who then have to just sit and wait until, you know, the son comes back from there and they have no role or no part in it.
Bringing women to the conversation, Mukwena says, is completely out of the question. But on one point, he and the reformers agree. No more boys should die during initiation. But the question neither man could answer is, how are they going to find a solution that lets them make that promise? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Fereweni Mabratu has been named 2019 CNN Hero of the Year. She is being recognized for producing a patented reusable menstrual pad for girls in her native Ethiopia, where menstruation can still be considered taboo. VOA Salem Salomon has the story.
Fereweni Mabratu remembers when she returned to her home village in northern Ethiopia and saw women forced to squat over holes in the ground. Without sanitary pads to use during their menstrual period, they were forced to take humiliating measures.
How is that possible? And they were telling me that they don't even use underwear. And that was the most turning point for me. I kind of felt, you know, the nerves going from head to my toes. And that's when I said, you know, I've got to do something. Why is this thing bothering me over and over again? So that was it.
The more she examined the problem, the bigger it appeared. Fereweni learned 2 out of 5 girls were being forced to miss school during their periods, with many eventually dropping out. Grown women were resorting to using old cloth or grass as pads.
We're talking about always gender equality and all that stuff, but when the basic necessity of a young girl is not fulfilled, how is that possible? How is that possible? How is the country even going to be developed when 50% of your society, women, are compromised this way? It is crazy.
In 2009, Fereweni founded Mariam Saba Products Factory in Ethiopia's northern city of Mekele. The factory produces reusable pads that can last up to 18 months and cost 90% less than disposable pads. More than 150,000 free menstrual hygiene kits have been distributed with the help of a nonprofit group called Dignity Period. At schools receiving the pads, attendance among girls has gone up 24%, according to the organization. This month, Fereweni was selected as the CNN Hero of the Year and will receive $100,000 to support her work. She said the timing of the award seemed to affirm her decision years ago to move from the U.S. to Ethiopia with her 3-year-old daughter in order to pursue this cause. Now, her daughter is 18 years old and going off to college.
You know, it was the moment an amazing journey, and people thought that I was crying because of the whole event. But it's the whole timing issue was just, it must have been God's willing to happen the way it happened.
But her work is not done. She noted that there are 30 million women of reproductive age in Ethiopia, and the vast majority do not have access to affordable sanitary pads. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Guinea-Bissau is awaiting results from a second round of polling in a presidential election. And at least 90 people were killed in a truck bombing at a busy checkpoint in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The public debt of most African countries is growing rapidly. This coincides with the emergence of China as the biggest financial backer of African infrastructure projects, such as Kenya's new railway. China has replaced the West as Africa's primary creditor. Its debt, that many economists say is unsustainable and in some cases impossible for some countries to ever pay. Today, as part of our look at China's growing presence in Africa, VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg looks at its role in the ballooning debt of some countries.
Africa owes China tens of billions of dollars, and the numbers are swelling by the second. Kenya, for example, has a public debt of about $60 billion. Much of it's owed to China for the construction of several infrastructure projects. Kenyan development economist Anzete Were says African states find Chinese loans attractive primarily because Beijing doesn't dictate terms for a project and lecture about human rights or good governance, as many Western lenders do.
When you deal with European and North American governments, they have a very clear idea of how they think development should happen. It's sort of this feeling that if you use our money, we want you to do it this way. African governments have really become quite tired of that.
She says China's own dramatic economic growth adds incentive to borrowers in Africa. Were says China's rise tells African governments that the path to economic progress isn't all about free markets and democracy, which the West emphasizes. South African risk analyst Ronak Gopaldas warns against what he calls the myth that borrowing from China is easy, even though its loans involve less stringent conditions.
Whilst African leaders feel that they get a certain level of respect from China that they don't get from the West, there's no free lunch. And if they're unable to service their debt obligations, there will be consequences which could potentially undermine their sovereignty.
In Zambia, China has lent heavily for airport and power projects, and there are concerns those assets could come under Chinese control as the Lusaka government struggles to pay its debts. There's also growing concern on the continent and in the West that China will soon control much of tiny Djibouti, where Beijing has lent funds for ports and pipelines.
Djibouti's geostrategic position is very, very important. There's huge contestation amongst global powers around having a naval and military base there. It straddles the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea. It's very important to China. It's very important to European powers. It's very important to the Arab world as well, just given...
Djibouti has access to the Suez Canal, the shortest trade route between East and West. Gopaldas says if the West loses even partial access to the canal, it would suffer immense economic damage. He adds that Beijing's choice of Djibouti as the site for its first overseas military base says everything about China's future designs in the region. Were, however, says the view that China is somehow tricking Africa into debt infantilizes African leaders and absolves them of responsibility by underestimating their decision-making power.
The debt trap narrative makes Africa the passive player that's being acted upon, that is helpless, and there's this monstrous power that's coming in and taking advantage. And it really prevents the real issue, which is the accountability of our government in terms of how they use our public finances, how they use our taxes, and the debt that they get into.
Ultimately, says Were, the Chinese government cannot be blamed for the failure of some African administrations to manage their debts. She adds that African countries must improve their ability to sign good deals. Were says this requires employing skilled financial experts to use Chinese loans in the best ways possible, which also minimizes the chances of corruption and mismanagement. Gopal thus agrees that African nations must play the economic diplomacy game better so that they take advantage of foreign powers' growing desire to have greater presence on the continent.
Are they putting all their eggs in the China basket, or are they kind of looking strategically at alternative partners as well? Because the Indians and the Japanese are also kind of very interested in expanding their influence in the Indian Ocean. The Russians are looking to invest and be a key partner in Africa again. The UK.
He says African policymakers must begin to embrace the fact that China isn't the only game in town. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Sudanese court in the town of Omdurman today sentenced 29 individuals, including security personnel, to the death penalty for murdering a school teacher in the Sudan's eastern town of Kasum al-Garba in February. The court also sentenced 5 others to 3 years imprisonment terms for participating in the murder of the teacher. The family and friends of the late Ahmed al-Kair expressed satisfaction after the sentence was announced today. Among those condemned to death was the director of the national security of the town of Kasum al-Garba. The court declared 4 suspects not guilty. Ahmed al-Kair was killed on February 2nd after security forces had detained him for a week. He was arrested while taking part in a protest. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7. Visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.